Seventh Precinct podcast, and it's our birthday. We've been doing this for about a year now.
Amazing. 1 year old.
Yeah. Somehow, having done a book a month for 12 months, we've only done 10 books.
That's a lot.
I'm not entirely sure how that's happened. Or we are only about to do our 10th book.
Hmm. Well, can't be correct.
We did do like a sort of double episode at the start, at least, didn't we?
We did.
Yes, we did. We did spread it out a little bit earlier on, and, you know, time does catch up with you sometimes, hence this being a little later in the month than normal, but we are about to get into book number 10, the last book from the 1950s, 1959's King's Ransom by Ed McBain. It occupies a bit of a special place in the McBainiad, because it's been adapted so often, it's very well thought of. We will probably talk about adaptations and TV things in our bonus episode, so we will try and focus in on this rather exciting book for this part. I am joined, as usual, by Mr. Morgan Brown.
Hello.
Mr. Stephen Royston.
Hello.
And this is me, Paul, being me.
Hello.
So, King's Ransom. We've got a new crime to the set of crimes that are in these stories, which is kidnapping. That's the heart of this thing. And a huge moral story, I think, here. But what I'll do to start us off, just to get us in the mindset of the period. So from the New York Times in December 1959, there was a review of this book. And one or two of the things it says, he starts his paragraph, "Praise of a consistently admirable performer must get monotonous and even boring. If you're tired of reading here about McBain, the best remedy is to simply drop this paper and start reading the book itself." "The book is powerful and compelling, and one looks forward to a dramatic version that might be even more so."
Right, well, their wish came true.
Their wish came true in several sort of strange ways, in fact, but like I say, we'll perhaps save that for another podcast as well, and our bonus bit. So, kidnappings, true crime stuff. Most famous kidnappings, what do you reckon?
I should have researched this, shouldn't I?
In the UK, there was the Black Panther, who, what was he called?
Dennis Nielsen,
who I think had a career of holding up sub-post office masters, but then kidnapped somebody and hid her in a drain gully in a park, I think, and then it all went terribly wrong and she died. And
yeah.
I think he always claimed that he'd... she strangled on something. It looked like she was trying to escape, but it was never clear whether he had murdered her or whether he looked after her and it was just a terrible accident.
Yeah.
But that's quite a famous one.
I think most often these days what you hear about is incarceration rather than kidnapping.
Mm.
Kidnapping obviously suggests a ransom and an attempt to extort money.
Absolutely.
Whereas a lot of the stories you hear about people being held captive tends to be for more... terrifying reasons, really.
Yeah.
Like the Fritzl case and things
definitely.
Like that.
Incarceration or abduction, but not so much kidnapping that you hear about these days, definitely.
But there was a time, and obviously it still goes on, but there was a time when kidnapping was quite... I don't hesitate to use the word popular, but a well-known and
sort of high-profile kind of...
So I've picked out a couple of cases of real kidnappings to mention here, one of which I think might have had a little bit of influence on this book. One of the most famous ones is Patty Hearst.
Mm. Oh, I was going to say, was she kidnapped by some left-wing organisation? And she
was,
got
the
brainwashed.
SLA, who's... I've forgotten what the acronym stands for now. But, yeah, a left-wing revolutionary group in 1974. And, of course, she was the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
Who was the model for Citizen Kane, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Didn't she commit some crime? Like, she was involved in holding up a bank or something.
Well, she's famous because she's the poster girl for Stockholm Syndrome,
yes.
isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, that's the one,
in that
yeah,
they
yeah.
sort of indoctrinated her into their organisation and she appeared to have been brainwashed and become sympathetic to them. And then she herself was arrested for carrying out a bank robbery.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
For the organisation. And in fact, she was the only person tried, I think, out of the people that were captured for that. The ransom for that was a demand that $70 of food was to be distributed to every needy Californian. So this is what really weird kidnapping, because the motive was a social one. But when her father arranged for $2 million worth of food to be handed out around the Bay Area,
yeah.
it just went, it went to shit. Let's put it bluntly. Because if someone turns up and goes, here's a load of free food, you tend to get crowds and riots. Yeah. And it all went wrong.
Oh, right.
And then later on, they managed to distribute a bit more, but still they didn't release her. Right. But obviously what happened then was...
she kind of bought into it anyway.
She ended up, yeah, brainwashed or whatever it was. And then spent a very strange rest of her life sort of appearing in John Waters films and the like.
Mm.
All sorts of weird things. But she was very famous, very high-profile kidnapping case. But certainly not the largest ransom. I think one of the largest ransoms, certainly at the time, was when Victor Lee was kidnapped in and had a ransom of $1 billion Hong Kong dollars.
Mm.
He was captured in 1996 by a Chinese gangster who went by the name of Big Spender.
Wow.
You'd think that was a joke. I mean, really.
Had he seen, wasn't there a TV program called Spender?
Yeah, there wasn't one called Big Spender about her.
Was it Jimmy Nail? Was he Spender?
That's right, yeah.
Perhaps he was a big fan of Spender.
Yeah.
But the translation, the word fan, got missed out.
That's a hell of a motive.
Me, big fan of Spender.
Oh, blimey. But no, Big Spender was like a proper kingpin of this crime organisation and kidnapped quite a few businessmen. And after he'd kidnapped Victor Lee, he was captured not long after and executed by shooting.
Oh.
Gosh.
So he met his end in a dramatic way.
Ah.
But the one that is, well, perhaps the most depressing out of all of these ones, but the one I think that might have a bit of influence on this book, in 1953, so that's pre the novel, obviously, there was a kid called Bobby Greenlease Jr. The ransom was $600,000, and that was the largest there'd ever been at the time. He was a six-year-old son of one of the richest men in Kansas. He was taken from school by someone pretending to be his auntie, which, I mean, even when we were school kids, and you know, say no to strangers and all that sort of stuff, it was about people turning up saying, oh, I'm going to collect you from school.
Yeah,
this is the real world, most sort of extreme version of that. And they demanded this ransom, but they'd already killed him.
Oof.
So it's a horrible story. But, of course, what happens is they get caught because they go off and go, wow, we've got loads of money, let's spend it really obviously all over the place.
They were big spenders, were they?
They were big spenders, but they weren't big spenders. It was Carl Austin Hall and Bonnie Brown Heady were caught days later after attracting attention through free spending. And they confessed. But most of the money had been spent or gone missing. So there was a bit of a mystery as well as where most of the money got to.
Mm.
I think that's possibly a bit of an influence on
this. Yeah, you'd imagine that would still be sort of in the public consciousness to some extent when he's writing this. And
definitely. 50, yeah.
In this book, we've got a kid called Bobby who is the intended victim of a kidnapping of a businessman's, you know, he's a businessman's son.
Yeah.
But it all goes a bit south, doesn't it?
Somewhat.
I am going to say that with this book, I think McBain gets more literary, I think. Mm. I think he really gets beyond the accusation of being a pulp author and starts becoming something really, really, really good.
I think so, with this.
Really deals with the morals of the story really well. The crime doesn't even open the book in this one. We have two chapters or something of, or certainly a chapter of, a business deal, this weird... who's going to throw in with whom? Who's going to make this money? And it's he works for a shoe company, extremely concerned with shoe quality.
He's very concerned with that. But yeah, the first few chapters are getting in the head of this, the psyche of this business magnate,
uber capitalist industrialist.
Mm.
Yeah, he's clearly rich. A lot of the book's describing the trappings of the places the place he lives, what is. Families like what the background to him coming. He's sort of rags to riches to some extent, so he is that American dream thing.
But he has no respect for anyone who's not followed the same trajectory as him, really.
Yeah.
Such as his chauffeur.
Exactly, and his chauffeur is portrayed as someone who's been sort of cowed by life, who's a bit sort of
going along
a bit
for
weedy,
them.
Really.
Yeah, just kind of.
On a day-to-day basis, let alone when it turns out that it's his son who's kidnapped instead. You know, that does knock him for six a little bit.
As you'd imagine it would, really.
I'd have thought so. what I really like about this is that Corella is the main investigating officer at the scene. I mean, there's lots of cops, but Corella really butts heads with Douglas King, who is the guy at the shoe company. And it's a really good bit for McBain to look at how people act when they've got money. He sort of has this thing with Corella, who gets really nervous in situations involving children and situations involving rich people. Mm. And so to go to the kidnapping of a child associated with a rich person is Corella's worst nightmare in a way as a cop. And he's clearly on edge, and this guy's really rude to him, so he gives back as good as he gets.
It's similar how he acted in the previous book, where he goes to the ghosty house with the rich family and the butler. I can't remember which book that was now. But yes, similarly kind of a bit...
Killer's Wedge.
Yeah, Killer's Wedge is a bit similarly kind of ill at ease in that kind of environment. And it's the other really posh part of the precinct, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And it always gives McBain a little bit of a chance to kind of... just working a bit of kind of class commentary, doesn't it? Which is always
it's a touchstone of the series, really,
yeah,
as it
definitely.
Goes along.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very good description in this book of the different areas of the city and how he starts to get more and more into the history of how those places have come up. So we don't just say he drove down that road, he lived in that area. We start hearing about how the historical background to these things, which I presume has some parallel with New York in terms of, you know, this is a farming area that was eventually sold off, this, that, and the other. But he starts to put actual stories into that, and that's really interesting and builds up this amazing picture of the city.
Yeah, he describes in detail how it changes if you drive along the road from this area and then you pass through this neighbourhood and then the following neighbourhood and all the way back to the precinct station, doesn't he? It's quite a good little passage, really.
Yeah, but it's great. It's not just describing sort of a little backdrop for some crimes to take place. It's actually like a whole kind of socioeconomic kind of portrait of an entire area, which is pretty amazing, really. And to be able to do that kind of progressively over that many novels, I think, is quite an achievement, really.
It is. And talking about socioeconomic, I mean, the next era, really, where the rich and poor thing becomes such a big thing is the 1980s. Mm. In the 1980s in the UK, we were watching The Bill.
We were.
Or, as it turns out, in 2017, some of us are watching The Bill again from the start. And I watched an episode the other day, as did you, Steve-O.
I did.
Called Paper Chase, Series 4, Episode 34, Should You Wish to Play Along at Home, which features someone whose child is abducted. And there's a
rich guy,
the child of a rich man, rather than his chauffeur. And there's a large ransom, and his first instinct is, I don't want to get the police involved, like the character in this book doesn't want to, because he's a big businessman and it's all, you know, this, that, and the other. But he receives his instructions to go and drop off the ransom on a car phone, and the car phone is the technology that's introduced in this book as the means by where the kidnappers are trying to direct the money. So I'm convinced that whoever wrote that episode of The Bill has definitely read King's Ransom.
Well, I'd imagine
because
so.
Because I would just like them to have.
It's weird because you consider a car phone cutting edge technology in the 1980s.
Yeah, I would have
and
thought that was a novelty in the
1959 is pretty... I suppose it's like a radio, isn't it?
It's a radio
different,
telephone. Yeah,
radio telephone.
I think car phones were first introduced in the 40s in some respect, but obviously not commonly.
Well, they would have had them in the Second World War, wouldn't they? Like field
radio.
Like technology existed.
Yeah.
As usual, the war responsible for a lot of peacetime advancements.
Absolutely. So if you could afford it and you need to be making deals on the move, I'm sure that'd be something you'd be interested in.
Yeah, I bet it would.
Buying or selling shoes, maybe?
Well absolutely.
Or
making
stocks.
A power grab.
Stocks and shares in shoes.
Yep.
Trying to convince someone to sell out someone else to do this, that, and
the
other.
Need to stab someone in the back on the move.
Because it starts, he's well into his shoes, isn't he, Mr. King? And there's a very destruction of a shoe when he, like, snaps the heel off to show it's...
Poor quality
shoe work.
He's sort of king of cobblers.
He is. The king of...
Absolutely.
Well, I can never get my head round. It's always a bit contradictory of whether Granger shoes make good shoes or bad shoes. It's like, I suppose, everyone seems to have their own opinion.
Well, they make a profit, and I think that's important.
I think they've got a good name for making solid, dependable shoes, and perhaps
like Clark's shoes.
There's a faction of the board who feel like they should be going for something
snazzy shoes,
cheap and also flashy.
Mm.
Whereas he feels like obviously there's more longevity in a
quality
in quality, absolutely. Yeah. So in that initial scene, I kind of find myself thinking, well, you know, maybe he's okay. You know, he doesn't want to do this cheap crap. And then as you get beyond that, I kind of find myself thinking, oh, maybe he's not okay. Maybe he's the worst person I've ever encountered in any book.
Well, he has his kind of a personal assistant, doesn't he? Who's that, then trying to stab him in the back. And you end up having a bit of sympathy with Douglas King, but then at the end you're kind of rooting for his the double crossing personal assistant, but he's just as bad as him.
Introduced to his co-workers and his social circle, it's just like such a nest of vipers, isn't it?
Apart from his wife, who's kind of
the only sort of decent person in there. His wife's mate. Ooh, what's her name? I've forgotten. She's terrible.
Liz
is she's an absolute horror.
Yeah. Yeah, she's just as ruthless as Douglas King, but then she's having enough with the personal assistant, isn't she?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about... I think McBain, at this point, it still hasn't quite worked out how to write women particularly effectively. I do think it improves, but he's trying to cast a certain type of spoilt character, and the worst type is Liz Bellew is her surname, or Bellew, depending on how you pronounce it, who is just floats through life with a rich husband doing what she likes.
She oozes sex, I think, is how he describes.
Yes, indeed.
Small exotic xylophones.
Yeah.
I believe that stands for.
That's all it could do, really.
Yeah. Seriously exciting x-rays. There's not many words with x. No matter how old you get, if you have to do an alphabet, you get to x. It's xylophones or x-rays. Other than that, you run out of words very quickly.
Yeah.
But she's a character type that crops up in a lot of crime fiction and drama. You see that character type in Columbo quite a lot as an incidental character and occasionally as the main character. Faye Dunaway... She's in
one of the 80s ones, yeah.
She's that sort of rich woman who's got time on her hands as well as being self-made to some extent, although that's perhaps the difference between the 80s and the 50s, who then teases Columbo all the time. Very good Columbo.
But then I think you get the feeling that she does actually start falling for him a little bit.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? With his rumpled charm. While we're talking about characters... Steve, I feel I need to hand over to you to talk about the introduction of one of your absolute favourite characters. We've finally reached where he makes his appearance.
Well, yeah, I think we mentioned him last month or the month before, because he was on a rota, wasn't he?
He crops up on the duty roster, doesn't he? Yeah.
The name of Andy Parker, and his name crops up. And he's involved in this. He makes his first appearance, doesn't he? Doesn't really do a great lot, but it's immediate classic Parker in that he just spends his time winding everyone up and generally being not very helpful and generally...
grumbling, getting in the way.
Yeah, so he's kind of... introduced here, and he's pretty much the same character. Doesn't really describe him in this, I don't think, as much of a slob, but you're generally led to believe... Yeah, his slob-like traits are more hammered home later, I think.
Mm. We only really see him out of the office in this one, for a brief bit at the end. So but he turns up with Cotton Hawes, who has been rehabilitated as like the sort of nice hero cop, rather than the sort of...
Because he was bigger earlier. But like, his Corella version,
he's taken
Mark II almost, isn't he?
Yeah, he's moved towards that. So he turns up with Andy Parker, who's moaning about the weather, because this is set in... on a cold October day. It's a cold October day here, but I think this is a little bit colder by the sounds of it, this one.
Andy Parker's very... he's been around the block many a time, and he just thinks a lot of the things that they're doing are just a total waste of time, doesn't he? Quite often he's correct, but he's wrong in this one because they get a very good lead from the perseverance of the lab, the scene of crimes guy.
Who is also a character that's appeared before that Cotton Hawes has had a sort of run-in with, like sarcastic approached before. There's a couple of recurring characters in this from earlier books that you perhaps wouldn't expect. One is Peter Kronig, who is the lab technician who gets
finds a paint scraping so they can identify the age and make of car that
some
they're
very
searching.
Very good lab work in this one, I think.
There is.
There is also, from the very first book, Cliff Savage, the reporter, turns up very briefly to try and get the scoop.
Oh, that's right.
And they are not keen on him still.
No.
I think this is also the first book where he really starts looking back on the series, because there's two or three occasions in this where they reflect on, remember when that happened, remember when this happened, but not to the extent that it makes it an unreadable book if you've not read the other ones. It just gives it more of a life of like a department that's had all sorts happening to it.
And I think it signals his awareness that he's got already got quite a sort of rich kind of history that he's built up in these books that he can draw on, that he can use to create a bigger picture, which is great.
So, why invent a new lab technician when you've already got one from
who's got,
10
got
books
some interesting
ago.
Stuff that you can draw on? And absolutely.
But Andy Parker in this is the first new detective for a little while, I would say now.
He's certainly the newest one who's going to make a big impact in the story
and
going forward.
I'm trying to find something now in this, but don't wait for me because I might be going in and ahhing. But there was the sound of the papers turning.
Rifling pages.
But when there's a lot of telephone calls to the precinct, I'm trying to find it.
That's a good scene. I've seen chapter seven, I think.
Yeah, there's... Willis, obviously, and then there's another name, the third one there. Obviously, we've had Detective Brown's been it. Hernandez is mentioned for the first time.
There's Detectives DeMeo, Hernandez, and we get Murchison, Frick, and someone at HQ as well.
But Hernandez certainly becomes
a
prominent detective in some of the 60s ones, I would say.
Absolutely.
So, you can, the horizon, a bit like the Bill, the cast's getting bigger by the series.
Yeah.
And so, Andy Parker's, he's not a very nice guy, but as characters go, I think he's quite interesting because he's...
Certainly is, yeah.
If you just had a cast of morally spot-on guys, it gets a bit boring, really.
Oh, yeah, and probably very unrealistic as well.
Yeah, indeed. They can't be an entire precinct full of knights in shining armour, can they?
So you've got a bit of a slobbish idiot.
Yeah, and that's amazing because eventually, though, he's so part of the squad that he introduces another character who's in many ways worse.
Yeah.
But we are going to be a long way off, I think, before we start meeting characters from other squads who are...
This is true.
...who are so important.
And he starts worse than Parker and he's mates with Parker, but then he ends up...
Yes.
He becomes a reformed character, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
Good old Fat Ollie, which we'll talk about in the future.
I look forward to that because he's got an amazing...
He's got a very good
arc. Is the
probably
word I'm saying.
Good...
Not an amazing hark, an amazing arc.
We're probably about 2 years away from talking about him in any detail.
It'll be a little while, the rate we're going.
Unless we suddenly accelerate, you never know. Actually, you definitely do know, don't you?
Well, the other major thing about this book, and I think you're correct in saying that he's getting away and doing something a bit more different, is that you know it is all the way through. There is no whodunit mystery.
No, that's true.
The big plot twist happens right at the beginning in that they've got the wrong boy. But, you follow the activity at the police with the family, and then you also follow the activity with the trio of baddies. And you know it is all along. But I suppose the big mystery is how they're going to try and get the money. But
perhaps that's also a nod towards the Columbo style of thing where you know right from the off who committed the crime. And the question is, how do you narrow the gap between the police and the villain? How does
that
happen?
Yeah, the tension not coming from a mystery. It's by no means actually a mystery story. Well, I suppose, as you say, the mystery is how it's going to all work out, but you can say that about any book.
But the main feature of the book is like the moral dilemma of paying or not paying and the rights and wrongs of the decision he makes.
Absolutely,
really.
And then also sort of the contrast between sort of the ethics of the guy with the money who has it in his power to just pay some money and save someone's life, and then so it's like Kathy of the gang who committed the kidnapping, who pretty much has no power and no money, but is in many respects kind of the moral superior of these other characters. And it's a really interesting just juxtaposition, I think.
It is.
Absolutely. And I think that's why it captures people's imagination. Hmm. I found someone discussing it in a book called, and I find my name, the book is called Mystery Classics on Film, the Adaptation of 65 Novels and Stories by Ron Miller. Hmm. And he's got a chapter all about King's Ransom and its adaptation by Kurosawa, which we'll discuss in other arenas. Hmm. But he describes this as one of McBain's all-time best because its characters and theme were almost Shakespearean in stature. Mm.
Well, that's true, I would say.
I think it absolutely is, and the more I thought about it, the more I agreed with that as well, because even the incidental players at the start, the other members of the Granger Shoe Company, are sort of... It's a bit like having, you know, the scenes in Shakespeare where he has kings and dukes all sort of plotting and talking about who's supporting who and who's doing this to whom and where.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you have some large figures within the story who represent a particular viewpoint or a particular thing. Then you have your comic relief, who we haven't got onto yet, but it's a character called Adrian Score. And actually the Shakespearean thing works very, very well as an analogy for this, or a comparison rather.
Mm.
And I think that, despite sounding like quite a grand statement, it's probably very, very true. Yeah. And I think that's why these books are so good.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But Adrian Score is, he's one of our comic relief characters, even though he's a shitbag.
He is.
I think that's the technical term.
Adrian Score.
Certainly one of the technical terms, yeah.
Imagine him having a really, really weird voice, can't you? Adrian Score.
Hello, I'm Adrian Score.
Maybe not that weird.
You wouldn't get very far with his various...
You shut the door in his face, wouldn't you?
What's that you're saying? I'd do that for hours. Oh, I've entertained myself now. I think I might take Adrian Score to work tomorrow and see how people feel about him.
I'll be intrigued.
I've lost him in my book as well now, because I'm...
I'm not sure whereabouts he crops up.
My attention has shifted to the sound of me going...
Well, yeah, he turns up, doesn't he? He's a bit of a... we've not come in across him before, though, have we?
We haven't, no.
No, but the detectives in this certainly have, and they know him to be a trickster.
Crops up claiming to have all the answers.
Yeah, and he tries to extort some money off...
He's in chapter 7's quite a big chapter. He's in there somewhere.
Ah, right, okay. He tries to extort money from Mr. King and the police...
Well, it's part of McBain showing the reality of these circumstances. Because he's a high-profile person, this thing's been reported in the press, people know about it, it's a big businessman involved in the case. So Adrian Score represents the reality of the chancer, the people who try and feed off your misery and grief. But what he also does is then he uses that as an opportunity to put this sort of slimy, funny character in there that you really enjoy the fact when he doesn't get away with it. And the police turn up and sort of go, "Do you remember us?" And he tries his level best to go, "I haven't had the, the pleasure."
Yeah. But you just know he has.
Yeah. Brilliant. A Mr. Score to see you on business. That, and also he has a telephone engineer who's another one of his comedy characters who turns up and walks into this thing with all these heightened emotions, all these people going, "Where's my son? And I won't pay the ransom," and all this tension. And he walks in, he's like, "Ah, it's fine, your son will be back. He's fine, they'll let go of him, he'll be fine." It's just like, shut up. Do your job. He's worse than Andy Parker in this. But he's, he's just doing his job. I don't know.
But, yeah. He means well, doesn't he?
Imagine if all telephone engineers were like that. We had our phone repaired the other day, and Lorraine hasn't reported to me whether the guy came in and told us, "It'll be fine, you'll get your son back." If he did, that would be weird in so many ways.
It would be a little alarming.
It feels almost churlish to discuss the plot in too much detail, but one thing I will say, and I keep drawing Columbo conclusions out of this... Another thing that shows like Columbo do is they hang the story around a technology. Mm. And in this it's the car phone in this, but it's also the radio stuff.
Mm. Mm.
So there's an earlier sequence in the book before the whole thing really kicks off and is linked up together where Maya is talking to someone who's had his radio store robbed. And the people have only nicked bits and pieces, very specific stuff. Mm. And then that ties into something Corella had dealt with earlier. Mm. And again, that's police work. Eventually, the dots are joined later on. I like the diagrams in McBain books. And this is the first one that's actually got a literal circuit diagram. Mm. Yeah.
That's a good tyre track one, doesn't it?
But it does, yeah, you, very good you're correct. Diagrams the, in this.
I agree that the circuit diagram of some bit of radio equipment is
that's a bit special.
Is that what he needs to be able to tune in and talk to the car radio?
Well, it is. And apparently, Eddie Folsom's preliminary sketches from the setup had looked like this. I think I'll probably snap that and put it on the Twitter feed. I wonder whether it is an entirely realistic circuit diagram. I haven't done anything with circuit diagrams in a long while, but it looks fairly realistic.
It does, yeah. He's got the correct
symbolic bits
and
a mic
capacitors
switch.
And switches. Yeah.
600 cycles, 600 volt. But we'll put it online and see if anyone can have a look at it and tell us. But I like these things where the technology gets involved. Huh. Because obviously people do utilise that which is available
naturally,
to them for good and for bad.
Yes. And their skills that they've learnt in their prison classes.
Yes, they'll stop teaching them these things, really, don't they?
Normally in Colombo, it's something like the time that a fax wasn't sent or something, isn't it? Or the fact that you can press 1471 on your telephone and find out who somebody called, which is obviously Columbo's totally
Brave New World.
Which is a bit like this. It's like, you've got a car phone? What? Well, why didn't you tell us that? Well, nobody asked me.
Yeah, that's it. They go to actually make the drop-off in order to try and catch these people, and they don't bother to actually say, why has he asked for that specific car?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then look at the car and put the pieces together and go, oh, there's a phone. That's how they're going to tell us.
Yeah, because the kidnappers insist he gets in this car and just drive away from the estate without a clue as to how they're going to get in touch.
I guess that they've told him in advance that he's going to be watched, which, of course, they're not actually doing. But he presumably thinks that, oh, well, they're watching out for that car, so I'll have to take that car.
And
they must be, like,
something on the road.
Hiding somewhere or...
Yeah,
or tailing them,
but no, they phone him up.
Yeah,
they do, and clearly the technology of the car phone is not so perfect that they don't notice when he puts Corella on to answer for him, rather than.
Mm.
But of course, being a book, we don't know this. excuse me. Presumably, he didn't have a voice like mine. It's just gone.
No, they must have had fairly similar sounding voices.
But over a radio, over a car phone, may have had low fidelity.
One would imagine so in those days. Also, I'm sure Corella's probably a fairly competent mimic, given the opportunity.
Yeah, well,
I choose to believe.
He'd have given it a good go.
I'm sure.
As long as Mr. King didn't have a voice like Adrian Score, he'd be all right, really. Otherwise.
Where are we going? Oh dear. Sorry. Okay, I'm trying to look for some more beats. I'll tell you what, actually, in terms of beats in the story, when it gets to them going off to drop off the money, supposedly, towards the end, it's one big last chapter. All this stuff is, it's not masses of chapters, 14 chapters this book is, and the last one is everything happens in it. All the action happens in one chapter, basically. There is no other action sequences, no tracking anyone down and trying anything out in random hotels here, there and everywhere, like very often.
Which is not to say that it's not exciting, because there's lots of tension. The whole thing is very tense.
It is
tense. Even before the actual action starts, just the scenes with King and his associates are pretty tense. But then, it just slowly builds like a pressure cooker, and then it just all goes completely nuts in the last chapter, doesn't it?
It does, including some nice, what would normally be a chapter on its own. Excuse me. Now, I'm going to correct myself. The last chapter is chapter 14. Chapter 13 is the big chapter.
Right, sorry, yeah.
Chapter 14 is the concluding chapter, which is only a couple of pages long, which is an end piece back in the squad room. This is our post, in terms of TV stuff, this is that little post moment after the big dramatic conclusion. You have
a little coda.
The little warm down moment before the credits roll, and that's a nice bit of squad room business with
some good bants.
bants.
Top Bants in
Top
chapter
Bants
14.
With Andy Parker.
With the lads.
But they're winding up Steve Carella, and then Andy Parker's there, and Miscolo's crap coffee is part of it. With it. His coffee is described as an aroma that's assailing the nostrils. So, sounds really nice. And I like those little moments.
Oh. Yeah, no, they're good.
But talking about the language in this book, it's not Shakespearean language. Shakespearean cast of characters, but it's not Shakespearean language. Now, oh, that was a really long pause.
What on earth are you going to say?
I started breathing in and I forgot what I was doing.
It's like...
Evan Hunter, Ed McBain, worked for a literary agency.
Uh-huh.
One of his clients in the US was P.G. Wodehouse. And I think you can hear some P.G. Wodehouse in this book, which seems a strange thing to say because Wodehouse is seen as very of the past. McBain is seen very much going forward from, you know, Wodehouse is releasing books up until the 70s, but they're all set in this 1920s, 30s sort of world. They don't move forward. But they were friends. Wodehouse and and Hunter were friends. And whereas some chapters of this book are real stark, noir-y, pulpy type of things, there's a good statement on page 19 in my book, which is where it's describing some of the streets. South of that was Ainslie Avenue, and the change from riches to rags was subtle here. The buildings still maintaining some of their old dignity, the dignity of a once stylish, now shabby Homburg. And it has naked poverty, nakedly dirty buildings, and it's really grimy and dirty and visceral. But then you get one of my favourite things. We've talked about the author's voice before, where he's describing on page 120 in my book about people waking up in the morning. And he talks about this character, George, who is just the name he gives to the people who have to get out of the bed, out of bed in the morning in the city. And it that reads to me a little bit like Wodehouse. George, it's time to get up. And there's a word in this book, and the word is mrmmb. M-R-M-M-B-B-B. George, honey, it's time to get up. The Georges of the city slip from beneath the blankets. And there's just touches of Wodehouse in there, and I like that little sort of comic expression of stuff. It doesn't get too silly, but it's got a lightness of touch where you can sort of tell the same story about the same city in a very visceral way, a very dirty, dark way, or you can sort of talk about it in a lighter, more funny way. And I think that's partly down to his appreciation of people like Wodehouse.
Quite probably, yeah.
And seeing as there's no one around to prove me otherwise, I'm definitely
right. Well, let's say that's absolutely certain.
And I've not published it in an academic paper, so nobody can criticise me.
It was worthy of a long pause, definitely.
Well, got one.
I did like, I'm just flicking here and remember the guy who had his shop nicked.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Pecker Parts after his... After his name, his name's Peck, and his business partner's Irwin. And he says, well, why didn't you just use, your name? Because obviously Pecker Parts is ridiculous, and he tells Mayer that his surname's Lipshits.
Some a little bit of adult joking around there. Yeah, Pecker Parts and Lipshits.
Marvellous.
There's still not much of the sort of actual dirty sort of jokes in these books. There's a few bits here and there, and he says they talk about dirty jokes. And you have some of these, a few little rude bits and pieces.
It can be moderately risque. It's not like too coarse, is it really?
But it does increase as the years go by, obviously, as the expectations of the audience
change,
or the willingness of what
rude
they'll read.
Ones.
Yeah. Excellent stuff. Have we got anything else specific to talk about with this one?
Trying to think.
Oh, we're trying to blow the plot.
Well,
entirely,
we certainly don't want to blow the plot. When we were mentioning earlier about Carella and his relations with rich people who make him uncomfortable, I was trying to find it before. I think I managed to find it now, but I can't actually see it on the page. It's my favourite bit of Carella getting annoyed with snooty rich people.
Okay.
Humiliated, Douglas King stared at the door. Does it make you feel like a big turd, Mr. King? Gorilla asked.
Like, straight out of the police handbook, that.
I was going to say, that mask of professionalism, just slipping a tiny bit there. Yeah. But I would have said the same.
Yeah, because you do not like this character.
No, you really don't.
Douglas King, you know, hence King's Ransom.
Yeah, which just dawned on me today, having read it twice.
McBain titles are an amazing thing. Cop Hater is about as literal as it gets. Mm. King's Ransom is more or less the point at which we start to get what I'd sort of describe as joke titles.
Yeah.
But they actually work amazingly well. And the next book we're going to do is called Give the Boys a Great Big Hand. And that's about as jokey as it ever gets.
Yeah. Which is exactly what the book's about. But yeah, no, some of the early ones, when you have like the Payoffs and Wedge, even now I look at those titles and I can't really remember which one that is.
Well, Killer's Wedge I'd forgotten until we reread it, but then that's actually like that's one which has a double meaning and it's quite
that's
clever,
the wedge in the door. Yeah, so perhaps that's a bad example, but yeah, certainly some of them you look back and you think, oh, I can't remember, but. Give the boys a great big hand, or Blood Relatives, or King's Ransom. You can immediately remember which one it is.
Like Killer's Choice is a title. That could be any book in the series, pretty much, couldn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
I do like the joke titles. I like the way that the titles change over the years. I do like the pulpy, direct ones. Mm. I like the jokey period. I like it when he gets to single words as well, which is his stock in trade from the 80s, really, I think, isn't it? And it just becomes really stark and really direct. But the jokey titles betray a lot of intelligence and thought behind them as well. And they often have two or three layers of meaning, not just the obvious joke as well. But I'm sure we'll discuss that in the next podcast we do about the next book.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of anything else, I don't know. I normally just mention the sort of descriptions of the weather and the time of year, which is a constant feature. It's another cracker at the start of this one. It's obviously autumn when we get to this book, and autumn's not quite sort of pleasant sort of time. The leaves are turning golden and. But
yes, dappled sunlight, etc.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't make it sound quite so pleasant here. It's the scene beyond the window was clear with the pristine snappishness of October growing into November, each orange and gold leaf boldly shrieking its colour against the sky. Too blue, too cold.
That's a fantastic description of that type of autumn day.
Yeah.
As well, which we haven't quite got to, although we are currently going from October into November. And today was quite blue. And quite cold outside.
Yeah.
Not too blue or too cold, though.
No, not as dramatic as that, certainly.
No, indeed.
All that's happened is that all the leaves that have been blown around in the recent storms and hurricanes have obscured all the curbs of pavements that I've had to drive up to in my driving lessons try and park alongside.
Yeah, that's a bit unfair, isn't it?
Stupid leaves.
You should be able to get out of the car with a broom and like...
Yeah. During your driving test.
Yeah.
We'll just get the instructor to wind the window. You hold this out the window and I'll just go slowly up here and then we'll reverse back.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens when I try that in my test. Anyway, let's conclude on this book, which everyone should just go and read. I mean, out of all of the ones you don't want to spoil, obviously we can only do so much, but it is a Shakespearean style wonder. It's a great story.
It's a corker.
So I think we need to sum up with our Police Shield awarding ceremony.
Have you got the scoring barometer? I can't.
The scorometer?
Because, I'm always conscious to know what other ones have been so I can peg it correctly.
Well, I'll get the lengthy printout from Kenneth.
Right, okay.
And by lengthy, I mean how long it takes the Wi-Fi to work on this stupid iPad.
Kenneth doesn't work on Wi-Fi. Scott. Gas.
Yeah.
Valves.
See if you can read that on this long...
Punch cards.
On this long
punch
counterfoil.
Cards. Can I make it bigger?
You can try.
Crikey. Well, I've done something here. Right. Crikey. We plummeted with till death.
We did, right.
That was the ridiculous wedding one, wasn't it?
It was.
It was still really fun. Don't be put off.
Well, the highest is Copator in 86, and the lowest is the last one, till death. On 69, and then We've got a few 70s and a couple of 83s.
But some peaks and troughs.
Yeah, peaks and troughs, but we're on a severe down path at the moment.
Which
so,
I don't think it's a fair representation of the sharpness of that curve. I think once the graph expands, it's not...
Yeah, we've only done 10 books.
No, of course, yeah, no, of course. But
It looks like it's plummeting, but it isn't.
Yeah.
Stats don't lie. That's all I'm saying. But anyway, who am I to guess whether that downward trend is going to continue with this scoring or not? Probably
not. Second guess ourselves.
Well, I know.
You can prove anything with statistics.
You can.
Okay, well, statistics-wise, I'm going to pin Steve out of the spot first to give us out of 100 police shields.
Yeah, I don't often go first, actually, but now I'm armed with this, and I need to just have a little bit of a think.
Oh, he's having a think, ladies and gentlemen, and other...
Yeah, it is a most excellent one. I suppose it's not perfect in my head in that, yeah, I'd always do like you don't know who's done it.
If you talk about what it's lacking, it does lack a whodunit because you just know.
But that's just not the kind of book it is.
Exactly. So I'm not bringing that too much into my thoughts, but I will give it a very solid, nay, excellent 90 police shields.
Ooh, excellent stuff.
I would say. Because, it's got a good cast, a good plot, and yeah, you're getting a lot of people's heads in this book, don't you?
You certainly do. Morgan?
I feel like it's another exciting new direction for the series. I think the sort of social, societal comment element of it is really interesting. Fairly sort of like damning kind of commentary on a certain aspect of the American dream, as people were probably celebrating a lot in the 50s. And I think that still reads really well today. So I'm going to give it a very hearty 88 police shields.
88. Okay. I'm in that ballpark, certainly. I remember this being one of the earlier books I bought in the sequence when I first started reading them, and I'd finally said to myself, well, I'm not going to be able to read them in sequence, I'll read them as I get them. Because once you get them, it's very hard to sort of go, I'll just put you aside until I've bought the other 30 before this happens.
I found it impossible.
Exactly. And I remember reading this and being sort of like, well, that's different to the other two or three I've read at this point. But there's something really, if this was the only story he'd written, this would work as a standalone thing, because of its moral quality. And it's,
definitely. It's
the sort of social backbone to it, notwithstanding some of the modern perspective of how the female characters are written and that sort of
absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely, yeah, I can't deny that.
And so I will give it also 90 police shields.
Ooh.
Which should be an easy sum to do.
I think it will be 90.
Well, I think... Well, you know our system of maths.
Oh, we were round down, don't we?
Round down.
Against conventional logic. So, 89.
It's 89.
Well, that
police shields.
Hot dog,
we have a wiener.
Exactly.
We do. But there's plenty... I'm going to score some in this 100 eventually.
You reckon?
Well, they're going to be the perfect McBain, isn't there?
Yeah.
And this is entirely...
This is the McBainometer.
It's group subjectivity, if that's such a thing.
What if it turns out the perfect McBain is like Alice in Jeopardy and it's not in the series at all?
Well...
Oh, no.
That's good, naturally. But,
well, it's something we need to consider at some point is having a look at a non-87th Precinct McBain.
Have you ever read any of the Matthew Hope?
No, I've never found them anywhere.
I've got my old boss gave me quite a few of those, so I've got them. But yeah, I've never read them.
Well, we certainly need to do the Matthew Hope stuff, or at least the crossover one at some point.
Have I read Where There's Smoke? I think I might have read that one, which is, I think it's a, is it a private eye? It was called like Benjamin Smoke.
Benjamin
Smoke? I think it is. It sounds ridiculous, but I think it might be called Benjamin Smoke.
Well, maybe perhaps we could do something where we all read one different non-87th Precinct McBain, because I've read a couple of non-87th Precinct McBain, and bring that to the table.
That could be interesting.
My voice again.
I've just remembered something else that is of absolutely zero importance, but something that I noted
zero
in
importance
this.
Is meat to our...
Well, you must admit that a Christian name, Sai, is quite rare, and yet this is the second horrible person called Sai.
We never get it as shorthand for Sai, Simon or anything. It's just Sai S-Y.
Kramer, who was the guy who was machine-gunned.
There may have been a few more in that era. I don't know, there's Sai Coleman, the Broadway songwriter in there.
Oh, right, yeah, of course.
I guess there were possibly a few more sort of in sort of the broader consciousness, whereas now you wouldn't think of calling character Sai.
But anyway,
really, would you?
I just remembered that.
That's very interesting.
Okie dokie.
Right, well.
So, as mentioned before, the next book, should you wish to do your revision, is Give the Boys a Great Big Hand.
Tremendous.
We're going to chat a little bit about our book covers and our viewing of an adaptation of King's Ransom, and there'll be some different podcasts coming up as well. I recorded a spin-off podcast yesterday.
Ooh.
About an episode of Star Trek, and we're going to look at the film High and Low, probably as a separate podcast as well, to do it justice. So we'll see you in the bonus episode, and now I will say a goodbye.
Goodbye.
Fare thee well.
That was our birthday. Bye.